This is The Comics Alternative, episode 223. Reviews of Trump, The Complete Collection, The Few, number one, and Gumballs, number one. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
That's right. And on this week's episode, Andy and I are going to be looking at three interesting recent titles. We're going to begin with the second volume of Dark Horse's Essential Kurtzman series, Trump, The Complete Collection. After that, we're going to look at issue number one of The Few, written by Sean Lewis with art by Hayden Sherman. And then we're going to wrap up with Aaron Nation's Gumballs number one. But before we get into that discussion, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the wonderful folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll see that those discounts will be between 20 and 35% off of the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some incredible specials. Sometimes those specials can be as much as 45% off of the cover price. Sometimes 50% off cover. But often, you can find discounts that are more impressive than that.
That's right. And this month, as in every month, they have a load of bundles that you can take advantage of where you get a deeper discount on multiple comics from the same publisher than you would get if you bought those comics individually. And this month in particular, they seem to have a load of bundles from DC. I think you could probably get every DC comic for 50% off if you took advantage of all of their bundles. So check those out.
That's right. You can't go wrong with the people at Discount Comic Book Service. Every month, you're going to find some wonderful specials. That's dcbservice.com. You got to go there for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your books there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Well, Andy, we are in the week leading up to the end of Barack Obama's administration. In fact, we could even call this coming Friday Black Friday. Now, some of our listeners may not like it when we get political. We've done so every now and again on the Comics Alternative, and I think when appropriate. And one of the ways to mention the current political scene appropriate to comics is comments that Representative John Lewis made on Friday of last week about the incoming President Trump. He mentioned that he feels him to be an illegitimate president given what happened with the Russian hacking and all that.
That's right. And then Donald Trump came back with some tweets basically about John Lewis and about John Lewis's allegedly failing district and so on, which of course none of which is true,
of course,
and saying that John Lewis is all talk and no action. And you know, there are certain kind of levels that I try to stay out of political commentary on the podcast and my social media presence and so on, but this was a thing that really touched me off because, you know, I consider John Lewis an American hero and a man who has done way more than just talk in order to make America a more equal and more vibrant nation. So that was disappointing. What was I guess heartening in all that was the fact that sales for the graphic novel autobiography of John Lewis by him and Andrew Aden and Nate Powell appears to be selling through the roof, and Amazon reported, I think, that it's completely sold out at Amazon.
Yeah, I heard on the news today that sales of that book increased by, I heard, if I remember correctly, 100,000%.
Wow. Yeah. And you know, that's good news for them, you know, and I hope more, you know, more, the more people that read it, the better. I hope all my students manage to get their copies of the book before this happened, though, because I'm teaching the series this semester. So if they're if they come back to me and say, you know, I tried to order it from Amazon this week, but I couldn't get it, I'm gonna have to say I'm sorry. But then my bookstore did get, like, I think 20 copies of the slipcase version.
Okay.
And so they should hang on to those, and probably, you know, they could sell them for, they're it's $50 for the slipcase, I think, but they could sell that for now, like $100 to collectors on eBay.
Right. Yeah. You know, Trump's comments, or his notorious tweets, were, you know, sorely, sorely inappropriate in terms of a man who is all talk. I mean, again, how can you wrap your brain around something like that? And let's just hope that what Trump has inadvertently done in providing big sales to Lewis's books, is a potential bright side to this. Now, I know that a number of members of Congress who were begrudgingly going to attend the inauguration on Friday have decided now, given his comments about Congressman Lewis, not that they will not be attending. And I'd like to announce that neither Andy or I, in light of his comments of Congressman Lewis, will be attending the inauguration either.
You didn't cover this with me before the show. How do you know I'm not attending the inauguration?
Okay, maybe I'm assuming too much.
Yeah, well, it happens to be that I'm not, and now I can say, I guess, I can declare I'm not going because of this, and not going because I wouldn't have gone anyway, and have never gone to an inauguration.
Yes, but if we were considering going to a presidential inauguration, we would definitely reconsider in light of recent news events.
Sure.
So there you go. We stand on the Comics Alternative with Representative John Lewis.
That's right, and you know, I think I tried to put a positive spin a bit on this in terms of the sales of March, but I know that I follow Nate Powell on Facebook, and he said he's kind of disconnecting from social media in anticipation of the kind of firestorm that's going to happen. And I hope that he and Andrew in particular aren't getting hit with a huge backlash because of this.
Themselves
aren't getting caught up in it. And so I wish both of them well.
Exactly. The internet brown shirts are definitely out there, so watch out for those guys. And Andrew and Nate, we're with you as well.
Mm-hmm. So can we go on to a different kind of Trump?
Yes, we're going. Let's transition from bad Trump to good Trump. The first book that we're going to be discussing this week is Trump: The Complete Collection. This is coming out from Dark Horse, and it is the second volume in their Essential Kurtzman series. And this came out back in, I think it was late December. And this is notable because Trump was a short-lived, slick magazine that Kurtzman produced through Hugh Hefner's Playboy empire. And he had high hopes. He had, at least initially, a pretty high budget. But it only lasted for two issues.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently, as this book puts together, a third issue was started. Some of that third issue ended up as part of Kurtzman's next magazine venture, Humbug,
mm-hmm.
Which was only, I guess, slightly more successful if you could call it successful at all, than Trump. But this is basically Kurtzman moving from mad into this other humor magazine project, taking with him several people from Mad as well, including Will Elder, Al Jaffe, and Jack Davis, and Wally Wood.
Exactly. And I think that the editor of this collection and also of the entire Essential Kurtzman series, Dennis Kitchen, does a really good job of setting up the context in the beginning of this volume.
Yeah. So a lot of the early parts of this book are a pretty lengthy introduction from Dennis Kitchen explaining the historical context, the reasons why, the various reasons that have been floated, I guess, why Hefner pulled the plug on Trump after only two issues, of which there's some debate. And then at the end of each issue, there's a series of annotations that help put the issue itself in the context. So Dennis Kitchen's editing on this is pretty heavy. There's a lot of work in there.
Exactly. In fact, I would suggest that it's Dennis Kitchen's editing of this volume that makes it so valuable. I mean, it's valuable because we get all of the Trump collection together in one volume. But the icing on the cake is the introduction and especially the annotations. And, getting back to that introduction, I don't know if you read Bill Shelley's Harvey Kurtzman, The Man Who Created Mad and Revolutionized Humor in America. But he goes into quite a bit of detail about Kurtzman's time working with Hef, not only with Trump, but also later on with Elder and Little Annie Fanny. And I think that Kitchens does a really good job of condensing a lot of that information that Bill Shelley presents in his wonderful biography in a presentable introduction to this collection. So you don't have to have read Shelley's biography. It would help. But I think Dennis Kitchen gives the essential information that you need in order to really understand and appreciate the context of the first two issues of Trump and its demise.
Right. And, I think what you're getting at gets to one of the first things I wanted to talk about with this collection, which is how well would Trump stand on its own without this editorial apparatus, without the introduction and the annotations?
That's a great question. When I said earlier that it's great to have everything collected in one volume, but perhaps even better to have the intro and the annotations. I wonder if this would read the way that it does without the annotations. Maybe the intro, but if you didn't have the annotations at the back, what would be lost to people who may not understand a lot of the cultural references that Kurtzman and company made throughout their short run at Trump? Now, I remember when you and I got about 2 years ago, I guess it was, when we were discussing that first volume in the Essential Kurtzman collection, Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book. There was some context there, and from what I recall, both of us, we appreciated Jungle Book, but we weren't bowled over by it. And I think with various stories, you and I even made comments that, well, it's okay, but it seems kind of dated. I didn't get the same feeling from the Trump collection. And I think because it was so heavily anchored in the culture at the time, which may sound a little ironic because something that is very much of its time, you would think, may not be able to be appreciated beyond that time. But to me, I think what really defines these two completed collections or issues of Trump and then the third one that was in process when it was canceled is the fact that it does keep pointing a finger back to when it was produced. And I enjoyed that. And I think a lot of that appreciation does come from those annotations that Kitchen provided. Some of that stuff I knew already. For instance, the Breck magazine ads. I mean, I knew about that. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of readers, especially younger readers, may be completely clueless as to, first off, the hair product Breck, which do they still make? I guess. I don't know. But that series of ads, little things like that. So I think the cultural rootedness of his time, the pop cultural rootedness, is what made me love this Trump, the Complete Collection, much more so than I did Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book.
That's interesting that you say that, because, you know, to be honest, I found very little in this Trump to be actually kind of funny. And more of it, I guess, in an appreciation of its, what you call its historical rootedness, you know, even some of the things I did find funny were only, again, largely funny because I came to him with an understanding of the history and background. One of the big things I think that you see in this series, for example, in the two issues, Kurtzman and company poke fun at Westerns a lot,
mm-hmm.
In both of these. And it feels like unless you have a sense of the ubiquity of Westerns in the late 1950s on television and in movies, a lot of that stuff doesn't necessarily feel like it's that pointed. There's a lot of, you know, movie scenes we'd like to see, which is a carryover from Mad. And they deal with some of the conventions and cliches of the Western. Well, contemporary audiences probably aren't going to be familiar enough with that. And, the first issue of Trump opens with a parody of the Glenn Ford movie. What is it? The Fastest Gun
Alive.
Right. Yeah, as the fastest gun there is. And a lot of that parody is very tightly part of a movie that isn't really, you know, widely seen anymore. Mm-hmm. On top of that, then also kind of rooted in poking fun at a genre that isn't that popular anymore. So I felt like a lot of this attention to Western so much really fell flat for me.
You know, it's interesting you say that much of it you didn't find funny. Now, when I say that I appreciate the Trump Collection more than I do the Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book text, or at least enjoyed it, it's not that I found the pieces in Trump funny, but it goes beyond that. Again, I like what they're doing within the historical context that you were mentioning, especially given the fact that we don't have the popularity of Westerns as we mm-hmm. once did. And in fact, the parts of Trump, the magazine, that I thought were the most, for me, the most enjoyable, were those parodies that were much, that I remember from growing up reading Mad, things that are like that. So that parody, The Fastest Gun There Is, I really enjoyed. I also liked the Rin Tin Tin, which is another Western parody. Tin Rin Rin Tin Rin.
I think that one, though, stands on its own. I don't think you need to know a lot about Rin Tin Tin to really appreciate the humor in that, you know, especially the kind of ironic twist at the end, which was kind of a common twist in Mad Magazine, where the heroes turn out to be the villains, like in one of my all-time favorite Mad Magazine parodies, mm-hmm. which is Batboy and Reuben,
right?
I think that if I were gonna to call out certain highlights of these two issues, that Rin Tin Tin parody, I think, is one that I did laugh at and did find it that would hold up without any knowledge of Rin Tin Tin.
Right. To me, the standout piece in that first issue of Trump is the parody of Little Abner.
Yeah.
Little Abber.
Yeah. And I like that one a lot, too. And I think the second the second area that I think might, would be need more historical context too is that how much Little Abner shows up in this in these two issues.
Oh yeah,
There's this one straight up parody of Little Abner, but there is you know, Daisy May appears in a couple places, just kind of
God's littered acre.
Yeah, yeah. And that Breck. The Breck ad that you mentioned, the parody, was is a reference to Little Abner as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going into this without knowing what little knowing much about Little Abner, and in particular, again, knowing how omnipresent Little Abner was in American culture, Kitchen does a good job of explaining this in his. In his notes, pointing out, for example, when Abner and Daisy May get married, it's on the cover of Life magazine. That's how big a deal it was.
Right.
So, so the Little Abner, L apostrophe L A B apostrophe R, is part of the parody there is about the amount of marketing that. Al Capp did with that series, having you know, all these different products produced, in that Little Abner himself, you know, Daisy May, the plot of it is Daisy May's trying to figure out how Little Abner makes a living, which for people who read the comic strip probably was a question. You know, he goes on all these adventures, but we never see him work. And then we find out that his job is that he's a really savvy marketing executive, basically, who's selling his own brand.
Right. Like Al Capp.
Like Al Capp. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's really funny. But I think it's funnier if you have an understanding of what Little Abner meant in the 1950s.
Right. Which again gets back to your earlier mm-hmm. quandary as to how useful or not how useful, how resonant, these two completed issues of Trump would mm-hmm. be without the contextual information, the intro right, and right. then the annotations. Yeah. You know, the other place that Little Abner and Al Capp show up is in that fold out in issue number one, Our Own Epic of Man.
Mm-hmm.
He's referenced there. Yeah, so throughout this first issue of Trump, there's a lot of Al Capp. Yeah, it's those parts of the first issue of Trump that really stood out for me. And I had a feeling that as much as I liked issue number two of Trump, it didn't do as much for me as that first issue, which has me wondering what would have been, and we can only speculate about this, but what would have been the experience of Trump, the magazine, if it had continued. So we had the third issue that was underway at the time of the magazine's cancellation, but then it went on. Would Kurtzman, in attempting to recapture lightning in a bottle like he did with Mad, have eventually run out of ideas? Because from the contextual information that Kitchen provides, in terms of that third issue, there seemed to be, perhaps, no one knows for certain, a potential redirection, at least when it comes to the cover of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a tension that, you know, Kurtzman wanted to redo, but much better and in a slick format, what he did and was able to capture with Mad, whereas Hugh Hefner, while wanting something that like that, wanted to make Trump much more sophisticated, which is one of the reasons why we may have, for the first two issues of Trump, kind of a pared-down, minimal cover.
Mm-hmm.
But if Trump, beginning perhaps with issue number three, had wanted to be maybe, not the best way of putting it, but less sophisticated, in wanting to maybe align itself more with what Mad was, but maybe for a more adult audience, would that have made it less distinctive? And would Trump, as an ongoing magazine, have lost some of its oomph? And there's no way of knowing that, of course. Mm-hmm. But I just wondered about that when I read this second issue of Trump in this volume, and I thought it's okay, but it didn't. I don't think it was as successful as that first one.
No, I agree on that. And then I wonder, as a kind of, you know, armchair quarterback, if it is a matter of, Kurtzman taking so long on that first issue and then really kind of running out of time with the second issue, because, you know, one of the comments that comes up frequently in the introduction and in the other material that Kitchen puts together is that Kurtzman was really taking a long time to put these issues together, and that that Hefner felt pretty confident that he was going to blow his deadlines down the road, and that this magazine wasn't going to come out on a regular basis. And I felt like a lot when reading that second issue that there seemed to be a kind of deadline pressure exerted on this, in that some of the stuff just didn't seem to be completely worked out. Mm-hmm. Something like, for example, the snapshots from the Trump family album with snappy titles, taking all these kind of vintage photographs and putting captions under them. Well, none of the captions seem all that funny.
No.
And not even in the sense of like, oh, I just don't get it because it's not a part of the culture. It's they seem to be pretty timeless captions. They're just not great jokes. And it feels like for the amount of space that family album takes up, which is about three pages, that feels like one of the areas that may have been, you know, again, and this is pure speculation, but may have been a little rush, you know, part of the rush.
Right. You know, another thing about issue number two of Trump that I don't want to say fell flat with me, but didn't have the impact as its counterpart in the first issue, is the comics parody. You know, we were discussing in issue number one the parody of Little Abner, mm-hmm. but in Trump number two, there is a parody of Paul Robinson's Etta Kett newspaper strip. Uh-huh. Now, I don't think I've ever read any Etta Kett at all. And the parody is Etta Kett, Etiquette.
Right.
And it was okay, but it didn't ring as well as the Little Abner stuff. And I'm wondering, I mean, that is very, very dated. You know, even though there are a lot of people, let's say younger readers, who may pick up this Trump collection and wonder about the details surrounding Al Capp and Little Abner, I would guess that at some point in their life, they've seen a Little Abner reference. Mm-hmm. But picking up, you know, looking mm-hmm. at issue number two of Trump, it's like, what the hell is Robinson's Etiquette?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. But I think I actually appreciated that one, not because I was familiar with the source material, but because it's I think it's a nice skewering of what do we call that, like, middle, you know, white middle class suburban sexual morality,
right? Trying to understand the younger generation.
Yeah, and so basically the deal is that in every one of these strips, Etiquette picks up a different guy. Basically, they go back to their house, and the dad, interrupts the romantic moments that Eddie has with her dates, until they get kind of, they're getting progressively more sexual, not to the point that they're graphic or anything, but just that they go from like hand holding to making out. And then the punchline at the end, where Eddie settles on her bow, is also pretty effective too. Mm-hmm. So I did like that. Now, it may be richer if I knew that strip more, but I think just on its own, that kind of parody of middle-class sexual morality is, was pretty fun.
Mm. Go ahead.
No, but the thing that comes next after that, the parody of the movie Giant, which is just called Giants, which again doesn't feel like much went into that. Man, you know, I've seen the movie Giant, and I think that I would not have any clue what any of the jokes were in this if I had not seen that movie. And so that is really, really dependent on, you know, the fact that that was a popular movie. And on top of that, having James Dean driving his car, sitting backwards in the car, knowing that he was already dead in a car accident by the time Giant came out as a movie, is that's pretty dark.
Yeah. The things that stood out for me in this second issue of Trump, I liked Mel Brooks's 2-page script parody of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman called Death to a Salesman. Mm-hmm. I thought that was okay for what it was. Mm-hmm. And it does strike me as pretty good early Mel Brooks. But even more than that, the things that I appreciated most in issue number 2 of Trump are the ad parodies. Mm-hmm. Now, we do have the ad parody of the Arthur Gottfried Lipton tea ad at the very end of issue number 2. Mm-hmm. But even more, and I think this is the standout piece for me in issue 2, is the Camels ad parody where you have a reference to Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko.
Yeah, I like that one a lot, too.
Sergeant Bilker gets court-martialed.
Yeah, which again, you know, it depends on knowing Sergeant Bilko, but if you do know it, it's actually pretty funny.
It is. In that other ad reference that I mentioned, the one with Arthur Gottfried and Lipton tea, I did not know who that guy was that Arthur Gottfried morphed into. And again, this is where Dennis Kitchen's annotations are extremely helpful. I mean, he mentions that Gottfried is morphing into Julius La Rosa. I had no clue what that was or he was, and Kitchen describes this, so I had to look him up. At the time, this would have been funny. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the thing that I appreciate about this is just the art. Mm-hmm. And what happens here in this one page parody. Mm-hmm. But again, the standout for me is the Sergeant Bilko Camels ad. Because I grew up watching the old reruns of Sergeant Bilko on late night Friday television in a local station in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I used to love that, and I thought that Phil Silvers was hilarious. And so it's just one of the things that I love about this. It takes me back to my own childhood.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, one of the other pieces I wanted to comment on in this second issue is the food photographs. What is it, like food photographs the way we would like to see them? Mm-hmm. Because from the notes, it seems to be that this was one of the more expensive gags that they did, because they had to hire a photographer and set up all these different shots to indicate the food photograph, the kind of parodies of food photographs that you would see in magazines. But it feels like a lot of, like all of these really just kind of fall flat. We'd like to see for a change one of those faultless photographs of faultless dishes, table or backgrounds with maybe one fault. And so it's a picture of soup and some wine and so on, and it's just got a bug on the table. I wish there were more. Or one of a turkey that's been burned and a glass of wine spilled. None of these really stand out as being particularly hilarious or even irreverent. Mm-hmm. Which I kind of wish they had been more. So
light humor.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, when you mentioned, too, earlier about where Trump could have gone as a more adult humor magazine. In looking at this, I do really wish that this magazine had been more of a kind of companion to Playboy in that sense. That other than kind of parodying things that maybe adults would have known about, like you know, God's Little Acre or the movie Giant or something like that, there doesn't feel like a lot that's particularly, you know, pushing the boundaries of humor, even the way that Mad did.
Right.
You know, and Mad wasn't aimed at adults for part of its run, or aimed at the same kind of the way that Trump should be aimed at the Playboy audience, or what Hefner wanted for the Playboy audience too. I don't get the feeling that Trump ever kind of reaches that.
No. Well, maybe one part of this second issue that attempts to go in that direction, and you can tell me if you think the same, is the rather extended piece, Sporty Illustrations, which is a parody of Sports Illustrated. I mean, I thought that this was okay for what it was, and it went on for, oh God, how many pages? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, if we include the cover parody. And Dennis Kitchen does speculate in the last part of this book, which we really haven't discussed much, what the third issue might have been, that this parody of a popular magazine, so like kind of like a magazine within a magazine, could have been a potential ongoing feature beginning in issue number 2, because there's the question of Will Elder's cover, the parody of Saturday Evening Post.
Right.
And, you know, might there have been in issue number 3 a parody of Saturday Evening Post within Trump number 3? That would have been interesting, and that strikes me as something that an older, more sophisticated readership would probably appreciate more, parodies of the magazines that they knew about and even read themselves.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that in that parody that makes me think of what might have been with this whole enterprise is the cover of Sporty Illustrations, which is meant to be a photograph. It's an illustration. First head-on photo of a bullet, and so there's a man firing a gun, and we get the bullet with the reflection of the photographer in it screaming as he's about to get hit. That's the kind of dark humor that I really wish would have been more prevalent in this, because that cover is brilliant. That it's hilarious. Right. Is it Will Elder?
Will Elder, yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't have a load of chicken fat, but it's got it's got a lot of stuff in the background that's worth noting.
Which again, Dennis Kitchen provides that information in his annotation.
Right. But that cover is really funny, and again, I wish there was more of that kind of dark humor in this book.
Well, you know, let's talk a bit about the last part of Trump, the Complete Collection, which is a series of images and just general documents, along with Dennis Kitchen's writing of what issue number 3 of Trump could have been. This I find is probably one of the most fascinating parts of this book. And again, it's all speculation, but it seems, you know, Kitchen devotes quite a bit of space to the Will Elder cover, the parody of Norman Rockwell in the Saturday Evening Post, where you have the older couple in the flower house, the hot house, you know, with the two grandchildren feeding animals, insects and a frog, to Venus flytraps. Talk about a dark turn. I mean, that's very similar to what we saw in that Sporty Illustrations cover.
Right.
And Kitchen devotes a lot of time to speculating as to whether this was going to be the cover of issue number 3 of Trump, or if it was going to be part of a parody within issue number 3 of Trump. And there seems to be evidence that could suggest either issue, right. You know, including information from people who were a part of the magazine as well, including Will Elder, because Will Elder has said in interviews that that painting of his was going to be the cover of issue number 3. But then there's other evidence, as Dennis Kitchen points out, that suggests that it may not have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, that's a great cover, and that's circulated in various places ever since. But it's good to see it in the context of what might have been.
Yeah. In fact, most recently, I have seen that on the cover of an issue of the anthology Smoke Signal from last year. I think it was the summer issue.
Yeah.
Which we discussed on the show. Yeah. The thing that I'm fascinated most about in terms of this third issue of Trump, or what it could have been, is the Flexagon.
Yeah. I cannot wrap my head around what this would have even been.
Mm-mm.
It appears to be something that you would have cut out.
Right.
And turned into, like, kind of, I don't know, manipulated into various shapes to get different images in it.
Right. And this would have been part of a fold-out section, because there was a fold-out in issue number 1 of Trump, which, among other things, kind of played on the whole Hefner product fold-out. There's a section of a woman who you don't get to see anything, but there's a comment, oops, wrong fold-out, in that fold-out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also referencing the Life magazine Epic of Man fold-out.
Right, yeah, that's the main fold-out reference that's being parodied here. But then there's also the Playboy fold-out.
Right.
Number 2 doesn't have a fold-out, but in number 3, apparently we were going to have another one with a Flexagon. And, oh, God, the way it's described, what is the official kind? I think it's a hexaflexicon was the technical name for this. But it is something that you were supposed to fold out, cut out, and then there were instructions on how to put together. And depending on how you folded it, you got a variety of different images. And some of them were on the more racy side, like a bathing beauty out tanning herself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I think the early sketches from Kurtzman, she was naked. But when Jack Davis did the final, she had, they call it a bikini, but it looks more like ribbons than anything, at least over her top. But then there were other images as well. A guy looking through a telescope at the moon, but what the telescope actually points to is his rear end, so he looks at his own moon. And then there are other images as well. This I find absolutely fascinating.
Right, right. And again, I would love to see what this could look like in its final version, but I think not only is it fascinating, but I think it does point to maybe one of the directions Kurtzman was heading, which was even more excess, because this seems like it's an enormously complicated, time-consuming project that would have taken up a huge chunk of the production of that third issue.
Oh, yeah. And this comes back to something that you pointed out earlier, and that is Kurtzman's work and his reputation as an editor. Mm-hmm. There's a quote early in the book of Hugh Hefner saying, "I gave Harvey Kurtzman an unlimited budget, and he exceeded it."
Right.
And so there was the danger that Kurtzman now let loose, because let's recall, and as Kitchen points out, you know, immediately before Trump, Kurtzman was still working with Bill Gaines at MAD, and Bill Gaines was notoriously tight with the money, and not just with Kurtzman, but with everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Al Jaffe points out in a recent interview on Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast. But I think once freed from the limitations of Gaines, then Kurtzman seems to want to push the boundaries with what might be possible, perhaps unaware that Hefner was going through some financial straits at the time of the second issue of Trump, right before it was coming out. So he was a little free with the, I guess, the potential cost of production. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he was also rather late, or notoriously late, with the final product because he was such a meticulous editor. He couldn't let things go. Everyone had to follow what he had in mind. And so if – and this is the case not only at Trump but also at Humbug and then before at Mad. Bill Shelley makes this clear time and time and time again in his biography that whenever someone did something, if it didn't follow to a T what Kurtzman had in mind, he'd send it back. Right. And this infuriated a number of creators, one of whom was Wally Wood, and he was the one creator associated with Trump, at least from the beginning, who did not make the transition from Mad over to Trump for good, as an exclusive at Trump.
Mm.
Because he had problems working with Kurtzman, as a number of people did.
Yeah, you know, and I think when you talk about that stuff, you know, Kurtzman's reputation and his pension as an editor, I really, you know, that to me has, for not only for Trump, but for Humbug as well, kind of gave it this kind of legendary sense to me before I had even seen it, you know,
mm-hmm.
that these were going to, you know, when I think about other places in pop culture where, or, you know, in our culture where, some, you know, kind of visionary, some singular visionary was given an unlimited budget or went way over budget on a project, because they were so kind of meticulous about their vision. I think of, you know, something like Citizen Kane, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you end up getting something that definitely was worth the money, the effort, the whatever pain that went into it. You know, you get an incredible work of art. And so when I remember hearing about Trump and hearing about Humbug and these other projects, I had this elevated sense that these were going to be just genius works of comedy. And it's disappointing that they're not, you know.
Right.
There are flashes of genius. There are moments in which they seem to be, you know, incredible and hilarious, but there never seems to be the kind of payoff that you would imagine if he had all this time, you know, if he took all this time and spent all this money on it, why isn't it better?
Right. Well, you know, I think you and I felt somewhat similar with Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book.
Sure.
And he did not have the kind of funding that he had with Trump. You know, that's an interesting comparison you made between the build-up or the potential of Trump and then Citizen Kane. Because with Citizen Kane, you know, we do have an end product, right? We have something that was produced that we can enjoy, appreciate, and critique. I was thinking of something more along the lines of the Beach Boys' Smile or Brian Wilson's Smile, in that's something that I would argue we never saw. Now,
right. We
have seen versions of Smile in legitimate, I'm not talking about bootleg, in recent years, but Smile from 1967, no, it didn't exist. And so it has that kind of legendary status that I think still keeps it fairly elevated in many people's minds. But with Trump, you're right. You would think that with the buildup, since we have two issues, once we get the opportunity to read them, they're going to bowl us over.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's why I mean, I appreciate it. And I think that as a historical document, this is incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love this volume and what Dennis Kitchen does in the Trump collection for historical purposes, especially. But you're right. The humor falls flat in places, is dated in a variety of different ways, even with the context and the annotations. But it's good. I mean, I appreciated reading this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think anybody going into Trump, though, expecting that, you know, it may be even as good as Kurtzman's work on MAD. Need to kind of be forewarned that you're really only going to get glimpses of the brilliance of MAD in Trump, and that's really unfortunate, you know. But because I keep going back to those early issues of MAD all the time, mm-hmm. and you know, we talked a little bit about this with Drew Friedman, how so much of my understanding of certain aspects of pop culture of the time period were preceded by the MAD parody of it. So,
right.
You know, I never saw it was years after reading Ha Noon that I ever saw High Noon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it is that MAD just happened to get lucky in choosing its targets that ended up being kind of timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And that Trump doesn't quite get those things, hit those targets of pop culture that would have made it timeless. But, at least in the early issues of MAD, I mean, I think later issues of MAD, you end up getting, you know, parodies of TV shows that lasted 10 episodes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I think it would be interesting to go through, you know, Kurtzman's run on MAD, which I think is what, like 24 issues?
Something like that, maybe one or two more, yeah. Because he was like the first five or six issues of it as a magazine.
Right. And then look at Trump, and then look at the later stuff, because we've talked about Humbug a little bit, but Help as well,
mm-hmm.
Which we're going to hopefully get in this series.
Right. You know, the experience you mentioned in terms of reading Trump, the complete collection, is a little sad in that it doesn't mm-hmm. measure up to what Kurtzman did with MAD. That's the overall tone of Bill Shelley's biography, Harvey Kurtzman, in that what really put him on the map is basically the high point in his career, artistically as well as an editor, and that everything that Kurtzman did since that point never measured up, but he, not that he necessarily wanted to, but he was always working within the shadow of his history. You know, wanting, you know, after MAD to go to a glossy slick such as Trump, that only lasted two issues. Then the people associated with Trump doing it on their own with Humbug and then Help, and then along with Elder, Little Annie Fanny, and he... I appreciate and enjoy at times the Little Annie Fanny strips and the other things that I've seen of his and Humbug and Help. And, you know, we can put the Jungle Book in this as well, but it just doesn't measure up. And it's almost as if everything since MAD was Kurtzman trying to outdo what he did with MAD, but not being able to, you know, sometimes because of his own... personality, for instance, him as an editor and being so hands-on, and then others from circumstances completely outside of his control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That is an interesting phenomenon. So that I think is where, you know, that leads to a question, which is, who are these Kurtzman collection books for?
Mm-hmm.
If someone wants to go to them and see, you know, the work of a comic genius, you know, like you said, Kurtzman's high point is MAD. So everything that is going to be a part of this Kurtzman collection is just a kind of shadow of that. And so I think they're interesting as historical documents, and I think Dennis Kitchen is doing a great job of establishing them as that. And so I'm going to be curious when the Humbug collection comes out as to how different it's going to be from the one I think that Fantagraphics did. Is that right?
Right, yeah. Well, that raises the question, is there going to be a Humbug collection?
Right. And that Fantagraphics collection is a nice slipcase edition with two volumes.
Right.
Because I think
exactly.
Humbug went, what, 11 issues or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm curious to see that. You know, then we'll probably get Help. And I'm wondering what – the things I'm really more looking forward to would be something like, you know, like a Goodman Beaver collection or mm-hmm. or a Little Annie Fanny collection. Because I don't know if there's ever been like a good – I mean, there's never been, I think, a complete Little Annie Fanny, but how many collections have there ever been of it?
Well, I think, and they're out of print now, but Dark Horse, a number of years ago, put out two volumes, along with Playboy, uh-huh. of Little Annie Fanny.
Okay.
And I think that they collect everything. Maybe they were hardbacks, but I have paperback versions of those. So I'm just assuming, since this is also Dark Horse, that they'll reissue those in a new volume. And maybe in one volume mm-hmm. This time, and a nice hardbound, as we have with Trump and also with the Jungle Book.
I don't remember that, so I missed that completely.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I remember when I got those books, and Amanda was in my study, and she saw those. She goes, uh-huh. But, you know, I mean, they're really wonderful cartoons, especially for what they do in of their time. Mm-hmm. They're racy, but and also I have some childhood fondness because when I was a kid and old enough to go into a 7-Eleven and get copies of Playboy, which I did as soon as I could. I felt extremely self-conscious about that. But I specifically remember loving the Little Annie Fanny strips. But that was in the very last days of Little Annie Fanny that I started to buy as a kid, Playboy.
Hmm.
And the thing is, the owner of that 7-Eleven lived in my neighborhood, and he sold them to me. And he knew my parents.
Hmm. Well.
Anyway, I'm glad to have the Essential Kurtzman books. And I don't know if we're going to get one about every 2 years, but, you know, it was 2 years before, you know, in the previous mm-hmm. one. Now we have this Trump collection. And so maybe in another 2 years we'll get the next one, whatever that one will be.
This one was pretty delayed too, right? Because I went and looked back in my my PDFs, and I feel like we got we got a PDF of this back in August.
Yeah, I think this was going to come out in the early fall of 2016, and then it was delayed until December. And I think, if I remember what a publicist at Dark Horse told me, is there were problems with shipping, and I think from the printer. Mm. And I think it was coming from overseas. Okay. Maybe in China, I'm not sure, but there were problems with that. But now our listeners can definitely get a copy of Trump, the Complete Collection.
Yes.
So let's transition into the second title that we're going to be looking at this week, and this is issue number one of The Few, written by Sean Lewis with art by Hayden Sherman. This is coming out from Image, and the first issue comes out the day that this episode goes up, January 18th.
Okay. Yeah, that's right, because comics are going to be – oh, yeah. No, comics aren't going to be delayed, so that's, the Wednesday – this goes up also the day after my birthday, so that's exciting.
Happy birthday.
Thanks. So the Few is, and we've gotten this first issue, and it's an oversized first issue, right? It's pretty long,
right, over 40 some pages.
Yeah. And we're in a post-apocalyptic world, it seems. And we're following basically a female character who is rescued a baby from a massacre of these, I guess, government agents of some kind, and she's on the run with this baby.
Right. I'm looking up right now the solicit for issue number one, and I can't remember what issue of previews it was in, but I'm looking online. Okay, and this is okay, this I'm assuming this is what was in the previews. Critically lauded writer and playwright Sean Lewis follows up the cult favorites Saints, which we actually didn't discuss on the podcast, unfortunately, with his newest book, The Few, teaming with red-hot artist Hayden Sherman for a limited maxi-series. The Few combines Mad Max action with a Station 11 sensibility in this sci-fi series for mature readers. Okay, and this is the part that I wanted to get to. In a dystopian future, two survivalist brothers stumble across an unlikely sight. A woman asleep in the woods, holding nothing but a gun and a baby wearing a gas mask. As these boys begin to embark on helping this woman, betrayals, secrets, and revolutions abound in the fight for what's left of America. Mm-hmm. Now, from that solicit, I think the first issue does satisfy most of what we get in the synopsis. Mm-hmm. The one big question I have, not only from this solicit, but I guess primarily from after reading this first issue, is that last part, the fight for what's left of America. I think that, I mean, I enjoyed this first issue, and I know that something is up and something is amiss in this maxi series. What's going on? That's never explained in any way in issue number one of The Few, The Fight for What's Left of America.
Right, right. So we do, most of this issue is taken up with this character, Hale, her name is, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the run with this baby, and it is only till late in the issue that we get to see these two brothers. And so that solicit also makes it seem like those two brothers are the main characters of the series. And yet they don't show up till I think page 30 or so of this pretty lengthy issue. So that, you know, that comes as a surprise to me as well, that's the way this issue is being framed. But I think one of the things I really appreciated about this book, was that it really uses its length to let Sherman's art breathe. There are if you were just to kind of go through and read this book, it wouldn't take you very long.
No.
In fact, it would be pretty quick for a 40 plus 50 or so page comic. But when I was reading it, I wanted to kind of linger on Sherman's art, which feels to me like a kind of it's got elements of Frank Miller and Sean Murphy in it, and I just really liked looking at this book a lot.
Right, and I like the way you put that, a little bit of Frank Miller, a little bit of Sean Murphy. They had an artistic love child. We may have Hayden Sherman. I liked the fact that they used the expanded page count to let the story pace itself slowly at first, but slowly in a good way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there may be some readers out there who have the experience that you just described of going through this first issue fairly quickly and thinking, I paid, I don't know how much
$5.
Is it $5, $4.99? Mm. I paid $5 for this. If they're only wanting story beats, well, okay, but there's much more to this first issue of The Few than just the story. You know, I agree with you that Sherman's art really does stand out here. And along with that, the way that Lewis has written this story, I mean, take it in a little at a time. I mean, look at the art and let the first installment of this maxi series play itself out. Like, for instance, the first few pages, we see that the character Eden Hale is in the woods, and we get three pages of a wooded scene before we actually see her face.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I really enjoyed that fact, and the rest of the issue kind of plays out with a kind of similar pacing. So I think we have a good setup in this first issue. But again, coming back to this whole what's happened to America thing, I don't know if that's absolutely necessary, that you would need something that to take away from the first mm-hmm. issue. There is one page, though, at the very beginning of this first issue that does give us some kind of clue of what's going on. And I'm assuming that you and I are looking from an uncorrected PDF that we've right. got from Image. And I'm assuming that this is going to be at the very beginning of issue one in the final. And this is a one page map of the United States. And what's gone on in this futuristic U.S. has something to do with water or water availability.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see on the map, it says Palace drinking water status. Well, what is Palace? Well, there's a legend underneath the map that there are certain states, mostly located on the east and west coast, but some in the very middle.
Just north and south Dakota.
North and south Dakota, right. That appear to be part of the under Palace control, whatever that is, we don't know yet.
All right.
And then there are also indications of where water supplies, clean water supplies, are located, which seems to be mostly in the center of the country outside of Palace control. So there's a lot there to speculate on, but not much solid information to go with as to what this future America is, what's gone on. It has something to do with water, but other than that, I mean, I'm hoping that many of these questions will begin to be answered in issue number two.
Yeah, in issue number two and following, and I think what you're raising there also points to something about the ending of this issue. And I don't want to give away too much about the ending, but it felt like that the revelation at the end in the narrative caption boxes from Eden Hale are supposed to be a kind of big revelation. But that's only clear if you really understand what the sides are in this conflict that's going right. on in the U.S. and we're not really given enough information to really get invested in that conflict yet.
Exactly.
And so rather than being a kind of twist ending, what I think it does more than that is in a sense be setting up the later issues, that whatever is important about the information we're given at the end of this issue will become apparent as later issues progress.
Mm. Now, have they announced how many issues are going to be a part of this? It's because they're calling it, in the solicit of issue number one, a maxi series, so not a mini series. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many issues this is going to be, because my question is, along with, you know, how many issues this will be, might this read better in trade,
yeah,
because of these questions that you raise. And I'm right with you. We don't want to give anything away about the very last page. But I have to tell you, without knowing much of like who's on what side or what the sides actually are, I was confused by the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm okay with this because I'm trusting the creators in issue two and then into three to answer these questions and make me less confused. But by the time I got to the end of issue number one, I thought, okay, well, what does this mean that one person is on one side or doing something against some other side? And who are these sides? And you know, who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? What's going on here? Give me a little more context. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm okay with the ambiguity at the end of this issue, but I can anticipate a number of readers picking up issue number one of The Few, especially after dishing out $4.99 and wondering, what the hell's going on? I feel cheated now.
Yeah, I mean, that could be a possible reaction, and that's a risk that any kind of first issue runs. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about, you know, we talk a lot about first issues on the show, but one of the things we talk about with first issues is how they function, you know, how they function as an enticement to read the rest of the series. And so do you treat it like you treat a pilot episode of a TV show where you need to get you usually need to get the viewers up to speed to some degree with the world that the story is taking place in. Or do you treat it as the, you know, the first chapter of a book, in which case you're going to get, you're going to get succeeding chapters that you would read relatively soon after reading the first chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is one final page, and again, I don't want to give anything away here, but it's a portion of a profile of Ed and Hale that I think helps to answer possibly, maybe, some of the questions about who's who and what's what is going on in this world of the few. But again, it's only just a little glimpse, but that may fill in a little bit.
Right.
But I'm wondering if in subsequent issues we're going to have similar bits of the profiles, like other context.
Yeah. Yeah, so I get the sense that this may be a book that I get in trade after reading this first issue, rather than read it from issue to issue. And I think a lot of what I'm going to get it for at this point, what's going to make me interested in getting the trade in the first place is Hayden Sherman's art, which I really like looking at. And that's not meant to be a kind of slight on Sean Lewis's script, but I think Lewis is a good collaborator here in letting Sherman's art, run quite a bit. In this issue.
Yeah. And you were telling me before we turned on the mic that you didn't read Lewis's Saints.
Right.
Yeah, from last year. Yeah, I didn't either. It has me wanting to go back in and read it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious about it too.
Well, you want to move to the final title we're looking at this month, and that is Aaron Nation's Gumballs number one.
Right.
And this is coming out through Top Shelf IDW. And it's interesting, if for no other reason, in that this is an example of Top Shelf putting out a comic in a series. And, you know, they've just started to do this recently. But I know that with Box Office Poison, at least, it's something that has already been serialized and then collected, but they're re-releasing it now in color versions. Mm-hmm. But this is a rare occasion where Top Shelf is actually putting out a brand new series, something that hadn't come out previously in any format.
Right, right. And Gumballs is also... What's curious about it as a series is that it's autobiographical. It's Aaron Nation's own personal stories. And there isn't, and you get a table of contents here that has quite a bit of things listed. And so for about a 30 or so page comic, it's really a lot of short pieces, some of which are narrative, some of which are, kind of, personal ads,
right.
Others are lists. So it's a kind of hodgepodge of different approaches to autobiography.
Right. Now this is a single author anthology, and you mentioned the table of contents. I really like what Nations does in that there is a color indicator of the kind of selections we get in this first issue. So, for instance, up at the top of the page, table of contents, the key says that where the color red is indicated that these are pieces that have something to do with twins or triplets. And when you first pick up this first issue, you're wondering, what does this all mean? But then once you read the stories, it starts to make sense. Mm-hmm. The color blue has something to do with personal ads, pink with Tobias. It's like, well, who the hell's Tobias? And I just really enjoyed what Nations is doing here. you know, let's pause for a moment and mention something that, you know, we're going to refer to Aaron Nations as he, because as Nations makes clear in this first issue of Gumballs, he is currently, I guess, transitioning in a transgendered manner. Parts of this first issue of Gumball is Nation's story about his having been born sexually, physically female, but feeling more male, and what that means in his life in making that transition. Now, not all of the stories or pieces in Gumball's number one reflects that, but some of the earlier ones do. Mm-hmm. And I think that strategically sets a context in many ways of what's to follow. Because this second piece, is the short strip Stand By Me, mm-hmm. which refers to the film.
Right.
And here we have Nations describing or explaining why the movie means so much to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's part of his early identification of his transgender status.
Mm-hmm.
Comes about from how he feels about Stand By Me from first seeing it as a kid.
Exactly. Yeah, in one of the moments, I think this is on the second page of that story, that's really poignant is Nations imagines standing in front of the young boys in Stand By Me, and they tell him, "I know you see yourself in us, but you're just a girl. You'll never be one of us." Mm-hmm. And what that means to him.
And that's a real poignant piece, I think, that really captures what could be the best parts of Gumballs, which is the way pop culture relates to and even influences gender.
Mm-hmm.
I find this maybe a little bit difficult to review because there are so many little pieces in this book, you know, one panel cartoons on top of really short narratives on top of all these, or several lists. And, I think this is an effective, autobiographical work. It reminds me a lot of, a few things, but mainly a lot of the autobiographical work that's generally done in like zine form or in self-published work, like like John Porcellino's King Cat comics, where you usually don't get a sustained narrative in the entire issue. You get these short pieces, some of which are really reflective, others of which are interesting stories on their own.
Right. Now, if you do go to Aaron Nations' website, which is aaronnations.com, and there are two N's, by the way. So it's Aaron, E-R-I-N, and then Nations, N-A-T-I-O-N-S.com. You do get to see some of his self-published work, his zine work. Mm-hmm. For instance, one thing that I don't know if it's still for sale, maybe it is, but at least there are images of this, is a zine that he did called Introvert. And the fact that Nations is an introvert definitely does come out in this first issue,
right,
of Gumballs. Now, you're right that most of issue number one of Gumballs is autobiographically driven, but not everything is autobiography. So, for instance, we have a couple of pieces that are just one-pagers that are like personal ads. Mm-hmm. Like there's one called Philip, and basically it's just an illustration of this guy Philip and a description of what he would probably write or what he's thinking about as he's writing a personal ad. Hello, I'm seeking a beautiful damsel. Are you her? And then it just goes on from there. And so there's a bit of humor here. Now, if this has any autobiographical links of any kind, it's not apparent. But the autobiographical entries in this first issue of Gumballs, not all of them deal with Nations' issues with gender identification.
Right.
So, for instance, there's one piece that's called Phone Anxiety, which I really enjoyed, and it's about what Nation goes through before making just a simple phone call. Again, getting back to the introverted nature of Aaron Nations. And so this is just a one-pager, mm-hmm. but I found this interesting. In this, along with the other autobiographical strips in this first issue, I didn't think it was overly done. You know, there's kind of a stereotype of how autobiographical comics, especially in zine form, can get a little too personal, a little too self-involved, a little too almost saccharine at times. I didn't feel that any of these pieces in Gumballs were that way at all.
No, I agree with that. I think I'm really curious to see where this series goes, because we really don't have if Top Shelf is kind of committed to doing a regularly published series like this, I don't know if it's going to be monthly or bi-monthly or quarterly. Most of the autobiographical works that are done in kind of single issue format are what I mentioned before, like zines and so on, that and self-published works that are irregularly published. If Top Shelf is committed to a regular schedule for this series, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, and if the first issue is meant to be a kind of preview of what you're going to expect to get, which is this potpourri of shorter pieces that are all like you mentioned, color coded and connected to different themes and topics and people. I can't think of a lot of other like regularly published autobiographical works that weren't in more of a narrative format, like like True Story Swear to God or something like that. I'm curious to see what Nations does with this as a series and where we're going.
Yeah. Now, I would guess that this, the most frequent it would be quarterly, because the past two issues of previews, we haven't seen anything for Gumballs number two.
Right.
So that would just seem to be the case if it comes out, and it could be coming out twice a year. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see where this goes as well, because there's some pieces that, aren't autobiographical, and you just wonder where they're going. I already mentioned those two brief profiles, those mm-hmm. two one-pagers. But then there's the longer piece, Meet Tobias.
Right.
What do we make of this? I mean, I enjoyed that, and Tobias seems an interesting character. Is Tobias based on someone that Nations knows or had once known, or is Tobias in some ways maybe a fictional creation that manifest parts of him, Nations, in some way? Not that it really matters, but I'm just curious if this is going to be a character that we'll see in issues to come, or if we're going to see profiles of characters who aren't Tobias but similar to Tobias.
Right. Because Tobias is interesting as a teenage, a teenage gay kid dealing with his sexuality. Mm-hmm. And especially in a high school where anything, any difference is treated with enormous amount of cruelty. And so he's dealing with his attractions, to other boys while also, dealing with the kind of peer pressure and being picked on, and also being a vegetarian as well, which, is another source of anxiety.
Right. Yeah. And the way that this is structured, I think, is really interesting. And it's summed up in the very first page of this when we first meet Tobias. He says, "My name is Tobias Delaney. I've never had a boyfriend because I live in a small town where my options are limited. I don't know how to write a personal ad." So it fits in with those other personal ads we get in this first issue. So I thought I'd answer this questionnaire I found on DeviantArt. And then the rest of the comic is structured around that mm-hmm. questionnaire. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
Go ahead.
No, but having recently worked on autobiographical comics at length, I feel like Gumballs does fill an important space in the world of autobiographical comics. And so I'm glad to see it. I'm glad to see it existing, and I'm curious to see where it goes.
Yeah, definitely something worth checking out. The first issue of Gumballs. Mm-hmm. In fact, every single thing we discussed for this week is worth checking out. We started with Trump, The Complete Collection, the second volume in Dark Horse's Essential Kurtzman series. And then after that, we looked at two number one issues, Sean Lewis and Hayden Sherman's The Few, and then Aaron Nations's Gumballs.
Yep.
A lot of good stuff to check out. And here we are in just the first month of 2017. And if you want to find great comics like this, you would do well to visit the website of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. If you go to dcbservice.com, you're going to find great deals on titles very much like these. And then after you do get your comics there, get in touch with us and let us know what you're going to be reading. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message via SpeakPipe online. It's really easy to do. Or you can pick up the phone and call us the old-fashioned way. Our phone number is 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
That's right, or you can get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com, or you can get a hold of us individually. I'm Andy@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com.
And we also have our Twitter feed, which you can check out @2guys with PhDs.
That's right, but you can find us elsewhere on social media, such as on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, you can stream us on Stitcher, you can find us on TuneIn, on Spotify, on iHeartRadio, and on Google Play Music. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, which is comicsalternative.com.
Yep, so there's a variety of ways to check out how we're doing, what we're doing, and let us know how we're doing as well.
That's right. And we do like to hear from you. Until next week, I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy. See ya.